Blog Talk Radio.
Future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie ahead, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this astounding future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Man, I am doing great. Doing great. Hope all is well with you.
I am higher than the Burj Khalifa right now, I'll tell you. That's the obviously tallest building in the world and featured prominently in our promotional materials for the show this week. I was looking for a good space elevator picture, and I couldn't find one on Dollar Photo. Secrets revealed here. We use Dollar Photo Club for a lot of our promotional stuff. And you know, they didn't have anything for space elevator, and they had a lot of, like, futuristic towers and stuff, but nothing really captured that tower of possibility quite like this, I assume, heavily retouched photo of the Burj Khalifa, you know, with the clouds and the sun and the birds. It's just a very, very evocative looking scene there, isn't it?
And it is a mere 800 meters tall. Is that about right?
That's right. Yep.
Yeah, and by comparison to the structures we're going to be talking about tonight, a mere molehill to the mountain we're about to discuss this evening, and still a fantastic looking building, and and I know, you know, it seems like countries throughout the world always are vying for the tallest one. So I guess, hats off to them right now. They got the tallest one.
They've got the biggest building for now, and a very cool looking building it is too. I must say, it's got a real, I don't know, like Lord of the Rings feel to it or something from a distance. You know, you look at it often, it's like you would expect Sauron to be in there or something like that. I don't know. I think it cuts quite a figure. Yeah, so we're going to be talking about the Tower of Possibility that is this idea space elevator. We'll be getting to that a little bit later. Before we do, we're going to do an update on one of the topics that we discussed last week, specifically human enhancement as regards our cognitive function. We talked a little bit about the drug modafinil, and we talked about the upcoming, actually now premiered TV series Limitless. Stephen,
Unfortunately, I have not yet. So, and I imagine there are several members of our audience that are still yet to watch it on their TiVo. So, our discussion tonight, we ought to try to keep it as spoiler-free as possible. And
Let me tell you. No.
Yeah. Here's how it ends.
Yeah. I'm going to spoil the end of the series, not just the end of the first show.
But, Dumbledore dies in that one. Okay. Anyway.
Exactly. No, I haven't caught it myself, so it's in my queue of things to watch. I'll probably get to it. Probably get to it this weekend. But I do have an update from a listener who sent me an email on the subject. And this is let me just read this message that we got. It says, just listened to the show and wanted to follow up on my own experience and research of modafinil. Stephen raised a few points that I can knock down, so take that, Stephen. I've been working with my brain doctor, who is a neurologist with a sideline in psychosomatic illnesses. I had a really bad reaction to a heartburn medicine a couple years back, and it essentially would stop my heart for long enough for me to really feel it about 20 times a day. It took months to realize that it was the medicine, and months more to get the absolute all clear on the heart problems. However, in that time of extreme fear, I'd wake up 30 times a night and could hardly move from room to room without sheer pure panic. It was literally 24/7. This left me with symptoms akin to post-traumatic stress, and that's when I started seeing the doctor. Over the last year and a half, we've tried lots of mild medicines, as I have opposite or weird reactions to everything, but we've settled on a medicine made for children to stop them peeing the bed. And I take a third of a children's dose. Sorry, that's just so out of context to read that. Not important, but a fun fact. So once we had a handle on the PTSD, the plan was to restore my Ferrari brain, my doctor's words, back to its previous glory, and we pretty much cracked that over time. I mean, there was a time I couldn't even work. I had spent the last 12 months telling her about modafinil and giving her every study I could get my hands on. I've been watching the science for as long as I've listened to you guys, and had the odd chat with some mutual friends about it. As we were able to talk on a good level about the science, she did her own research, she being the doctor here, I believe, talked to colleagues in other countries, and finally, about 3 months ago, we moved on to enhancement rather than just cure. I've had the Interaxon Muse device for some time now and was able to show her that I could achieve a mind-off Zen state almost immediately while hooked up to an EEG. So we've talked about these devices in the past, and here one of our listeners is actually a user and has already achieved some pretty remarkable neurological stuff with it. In fact, I did it twice in 1 minute, talking to her in between, and she said she's honestly never seen that before, especially in a clinic with two doctors in the room. So having proved that I am mind sound, she finally relented and prescribed me the modafinil. Apparently, I'm the first person in the country to get on the drug on insurance for a non-sleep-related disorder. This makes a big difference, like 50 cents, not $40 a pill. I think she's allowed to do this as long as she writes a research paper on it. So I've effectively been taking modafinil for the whole 3 months, and now most days it's been interesting. There are no shaky side effects, and even after taking it, I can still do the meditation trick, slow my heart rate, etc. The effect of the drug is something that you are getting right now, a load of babble, extra long messages, and a light but controllable hyperactiveness. Actually, I would say what I was experiencing reading this is just a very lucid and articulate description of a story. I've even had the odd limitless moment where I've quoted archaic German from a Goethe poem to my German friend while we were at dinner. I clearly remembered reading it as a child in the back of a dictionary, and it was such a weird reference, she even had to look it up. This kind of thing has happened a few times. I also had lots of set phrases from movies I threw in, too, in German. I don't know this listener's actual background with German, but apparently not a fluent speaker, and suddenly picking up German all over the place, which is very interesting. Also, at an art exhibition...
Even more interestingly, memories of German absorbed maybe on one occasion as a child. That's pretty cool.
It's astounding, actually. At an art exhibition, I had a conversation with a guy who runs some private schools about education methods, and he pulled out a notebook in the bar. I told him to put it away, I'd remember for him, and email him the next day. Poor guy got 6,000-word synopsis in 4 parts. He's offering me a job to write the curriculum. My day is usually as follows. Espresso in the morning, modafinil around lunchtime or even up to 4 p.m., and another espresso at 6. I sleep like a baby whenever I choose to. I go to bed at 11, fine, or I can stay up working till 3, fine. I don't even yawn, and that's weird. Now for the long term. There have been a lot of studies into the drug, and of course the Army switched from amphetamines to modafinil many years ago. You can look up how it works for helicopter pilots, giving them workable accuracy for up to 36 hours. In 2011, after the quake and radiation problems, a Navy nuclear tech friend of mine who lives in Japan essentially worked around the clock for 3 days in a sub monitoring the damage and leakage. Guess what he was taking? There have also been tests into its effects on Alzheimer's, depression, stress, creativity, ADHD, and much more. But finally, someone has done a meta-study collating the data, long-term effects, effects on different disorders, effects on different personality types, ages, etc., and he provides a link for that, and adds, the only negative anecdote I have on the drug is the same Navy friend who took a double dose of modafinil and a liter of coffee while doing what's listed as the second hardest and brainiest job in the military. And There's a link that talks about that. It was an emergency situation, but in his own words, the mixture, he said, never again. So I'm truly sorry you had to read this much just to get to the links, but as I say to my wife now, instead of sorry when I overdo it, modafinil. Well, to our reader, I just want to say thank you so much for our listener. Thank you so much for sharing your story. And I'll tell you, that's a pretty inspiring story. What do you think, Stephen?
Yeah, and I think what it points to is the possibility of, as he suggests, that we're not just talking about curing potential problems, but also enhancing. You know, I mean, and not just necessarily enhancing in a way that allows you to stay up for a couple of days without sleep and continue to function at 100%, but also beyond that, you know, some pretty impressive mental feats. Now, I get, having read email from this particular listener before and things like this, I get the feeling that this guy is particularly smart to begin with.
Well, World Transform listener. Hello, World Transform listener.
Come on, yeah, of course it's going to be brilliant. But we flatter ourselves, don't we? But at any rate.
We started above average and work up. Okay.
This appears to have had granted some additional capability here, and that, you know, it's the sort of thing that college just a slight edge can provide. Like, for example, someone in college or in some sort of competitive race for a position at work or something like that. You can imagine the desire. To have access to something like this, to give you the edge, obviously a lot of study is needed for things like this, but it's exciting. It's kind of a neat thing, isn't it?
It absolutely is, and we'll be sharing those additional links that I mentioned in the email. I'll be putting those into both blogtalkradio.com and worldtransform.com, so you can follow those links and read more about. Modafinil, but I'll tell you what I find most impressive is the idea of just sort of incorporating that boost into your everyday life.
Right.
That's not a course of action that you tread into lightly, but man, I can sure see the advantage of it. You know, it's like, okay, well, this thing provides the occasional boost, or you can just have it every day, and you can have a boost every day. And I think about, you know, the level of productivity that you could accomplish. And also it just sounds like, almost peace of mind that it seems to grant, although in a kind of a, not frenzied, but in a kind of an energetic way. Sounds like a really interesting, I'm very eager to try it, I must say, after having read this, having read this email. I would like to give this a try and see what it's all about. And I'm curious about one thing. And I never got an answer on this. We swapped some additional messages, but this one got lost in the fray. When he talks about, you know, I sleep when I want to, don't yawn, don't get tired, I wonder if you take it every day, to what extent you can just live a fully sleep-optional lifestyle, right? Presumably, not completely.
I think that you would need to sleep, if for no other reason but to access REM, so that it allows you to clear the slates mentally, and I think that's the real reason we need sleep is that we need to dream. It's sort of a reboot, you know. And without an occasional reboot, you have a problem with the system tends to break down. And so I think that's part of what we're doing with our sleep, if nothing else. So yeah, it's sleep optional, but it's interesting. It doesn't, you know, it's not like taking like a super dose of caffeine apparently. He can sleep when he wants to. Yeah, he lays down and goes to sleep just as fast as anybody else. But he doesn't have to. You know, he can stay busy if he needs to. So it's fascinating and interesting drug. And my hope is that to the extent there are any side effects, that they continue to work with it and boost the effectiveness and if there are any side effects, deal with those side effects. Get better and better drugs that access the same, you know, the same, it gives you the same capabilities, I guess, what I'm trying to say. So Fascinating
yeah.
story.
Although,
I really appreciate
good, good to hear
you
that in, at least in this one case so far, no side effects to speak of.
Right.
Of the unpleasant variety, anyhow. So,
well,
so great story. Appreciate the update on that. Would like to have had the had this listener on, but all told, it was probably better to keep it discreet and talk about it in these terms. So that's how we've done it. Many thanks to him for sharing that story and really giving us a personal dimension on this that otherwise we wouldn't have. I feel like we've had a guest now, you know.
Yeah, having a guest. Yeah, it's been a little while since we had one, and thanks for being on the show. So, yeah, that's awesome.
The letter served as the guest. So, all right, so now we're going to talk about, shift gears a little bit and talk about the adjacent possible. It's a bit of a shift of gears, although there's an interesting connection between the two, because I think one of the things we're looking to enhance when we talk about enhancing our brain power is just the ability to make that connection to the next thing, that ability to kind of see what's over the horizon. You know, there's this description of intelligence. It comes from the book On Intelligence, and that, off the top of my head, I can't remember the name of the author, but essentially what it boils down to, and Kurzweil talks about this too, what intelligence boils down to is predictions, our ability to make accurate predictions, not, you know, the kind that we make or often don't make on this show, talking about the future, but just, you know, predictions about how the world is going to work. The more accurate the predictions that your brain is making about the world, how the world works, the more, quote-unquote, intelligent you are. And so intelligence always has to do with making that connection and getting to the next thing. We had a great description of this. We did a show on this idea of the adjacent possible, I'm going to say, I don't know, 3-4 years ago. Does that sound right, Stephen? Maybe longer?
Yeah.
Somewhere in there.
And it's a it's an idea. I believe it was Stuart A. Kaufman talked about it as being that, you know, if for example, you know, if you're just dealing with basic chemistry in the early universe, the adjacent possible did not include, you know, the flatworm. You know, there are steps in the organization that had to be taken before you get to that point. And the same is true with our technology, you know. We had super geniuses, 100, 200 years ago, and Leonardo da Vinci 500, 600 years ago. Well, you know, Benjamin Franklin spoke of some things, you know, in the future. He said he regretted having been born too soon, and he talked about the possibility of depriving people of their gravity so that they could be, so that things could be moved around easily, and curing all diseases, not accepting even that of old age. So, I mean, he was thinking about some things that you know, we like to talk about on the show, but he realized that, hey, I was really born too soon for these things. I will not live to see these things.
Things, they were possibilities, but they weren't adjacent possibilities. That's the beauty of this idea. I like this quote here in this story that references it in the Wall Street Journal, where they say the adjacent possible is a kind of shadow future hovering on the edges of the present state of things, a map of all the ways in which the present can reinvent itself. It's really that. Actually, it seems like when we talked about it, Stephen, you had a great analogy of was it like walking through a house or walking through a building that you've not been before? And if you come into a new room, then suddenly there's, you know, if there's two or three
there's
doors there,
go ahead. Two or three doors right adjacent to you that you can open that you couldn't before, because you know you're in a new room, and you know. Yeah, and occasionally you may, you may think ahead and realize, hey, you know, I foresee a room that's like two or three rooms away. But you know, you've got, in order to get to it, there are some things that you have to accomplish first. I see that as a good way of looking at it. You know, you might even think of it as like a chessboard. And you know, if you're sitting there at Queens 1, then you know you're not going to get to Queens 8. you know, if you're moving one square at a time, you're not going to get there right away. But you know, it's possible. It's on the head. So
yeah, unless you're a bishop and you just slide right up.
Yeah, are you the queen and you can go all the way to the end?
You can go anywhere you want to go, exactly. but the point is, when you're in that other spot, there's suddenly all kinds of moves that can happen that couldn't happen when you're back there in the at the opening of the board. The deeper in you go, the more things you're adjacent to, the more possibilities there are. And in fact, I think this idea works really well when you understand that it's a moving target, that the adjacent possible is constantly shifting. It's constantly increasing. Actually, it's expanding. And it maps very well to an idea that we call the human imperative, which is this notion that we're just, you know, what we've got on this planet are some highly evolved primates, or at least we like to think of ourselves that way, who are just all the time trying to do the next thing, trying to make something cool happen, trying to make things better, trying to, if you will, transform the world. And sometimes we're pretty good at it. But each one of those changes that gets introduced, each new thing we do to try to make things better, suddenly puts you in a new room, and suddenly new things become possible. Suddenly you're adjacent to new possibilities that you weren't adjacent to before because you hadn't taken that next step. And in fact, I would take it even one step further than that. I think it's not even doing things that opens up the adjacent possible. That's the beautiful way to do it. That's the most obvious way to do it. But even just getting ideas out there, I think, opens up the adjacent possible. I think that once people understand that it's possible to do something, or that a certain problem can be solved, that opens up all kinds of avenues. And even if people don't solve that particular problem, they start working on something related, and new adjacent possibilities pop up. Well, this all sounds kind of vague when we talk about these terms. So go ahead, Stephen.
No, I was just going to say, you can't enter the room, the new room, without, somebody looking through the doorway and kind of describing what is in the next room. You know, you have to have someone that can say, yeah, this is possible. This is what, you know, based on what we have now, we can do this next thing. And, I would say that's exactly right. So
even what we do, I think, actually helps move along the adjacent possible. One of these days we're going to get an email from somebody who cured cancer because they listened to this show. But even, you know, even if they don't get around to sending us the email, we'll assume it happened. In fact, I pretty much.
Because our ego is that small.
Assume these things are happening all the time. But we're talking about the Tower of Possibility, and this is such a great story. This is something we actually talked about a few months ago. This story came out, I believe it was in May of this year, and we talked about it a little bit then, kind of in passing. It was one of many topics. We did a grab bag show, and I believe you brought this up, Stephen, the inflatable space elevator. Is that right? Am I remembering that correctly?
Maybe. I say, we each threw out about 10 topics, and maybe that was one of mine, but yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, in light of the adjacent possible, and in fact, just in its own right as an idea, this one is worth an additional look. As a reminder, and this is linked in the show notes in both places, this is a story in the Daily Mail. It wasn't that long ago, 14th of August 2015, but I don't know. It seems like we talked about it a few months ago. Maybe not. Going up, space elevator in a tower 12 miles high could one day give astronauts a leg up into the cosmos. Canadian space firm has been granted U.S. patent for a space elevator. The elevator will be used for wind energy generation and communications. Designers Thoth said elevator will make space travel like catching a plane. And it notes that space elevators were first proposed by Russian scientists in 1895. Actually, whatever that guy's name is, the rocket guy, right, of fame in Russia, also is the guy who came up with the idea of the space elevator. So what's different about this space elevator? Usually we talk about, let's take some some nanotechnology, right? Let's take some advanced materials, and we will
build some
carbon nanotubes, and we're going to connect. We're going to anchor a satellite in space to the Earth. That's the usual idea that we hear about for the space
elevator. And it's a top-down approach. You'd launch this giant carbon nanotube ribbon. And I'm describing something. Maybe let's imagine it's 8 feet wide and almost unimaginably thin because it is like a single atom of carbon thick. Okay, we're talking about the thinnest thing you can possibly imagine. But it's about 8 feet wide, and you would get this ribbon up into space, and you would from geosynchronous orbit. You would lower this ribbon slowly to the surface and attach it, and then you could have runners that would go up and down this ribbon to this the geosynchronous satellite. So that's the picture of the space elevator as we have usually talked about it, Phil, on this program.
As usually described, and it's a great model, and you gotta love it, you got to love this aerospace firm in Canada named Thoth, who have come along and said, without pulling off all that exotic stuff, perhaps a bit more adjacent to us, we could build out of inflatable material, we could build a tower about 20 kilometers high, or as I noted, that's about 12 miles up. You could anchor it deep in the ground so it would stand. And I believe you mentioned, Stephen, that's how much taller than the Burj Khalifa?
The Burj Khalifa is about 800 meters, right? Is that right? So.
Yep. There you go. So 20,000, 800 into 20,000. Okay, a lot. It's a lot higher, more than 20 times.
Like,
I mean, if they had only gotten the Burj Khalifa up to 1,000, right, it would be easier to do the math. But we know it's more than 20 times as high. So it's up there. We're talking about... obviously the tallest structure ever built. And it would weigh upwards of, they say, 10,000 tons. So even with all the inflatable stuff, we're talking about a big, big, big structure. The base would be about 3,000 meters in diameter, and it would taper. So the top would be significantly smaller than that, obviously. And they talk about, here's what you do. You put a pod at the top with 5 decks. Inside that pod, you got restaurants, hotels, and then on the roof, you have the runways. And the runways you need, because now you can launch space planes from 20 kilometers up that can make it into low Earth orbit in a single stage. You've essentially taken most of the heavy lifting, not all the heavy lifting, but most of the heavy lifting out of getting into orbit. You haven't solved the problem with perhaps the elegance of the traditional space elevator model that we talked about, but you've done it in, I'm going to say, frankly, a much more accessible way to our world. This is a plan that you can actually imagine them starting to implement. What's that?
Oh yeah, this is something that if we were to have a Kennedy-esque person come along and say, we choose to build a space elevator, he might have something like this in mind, because this is something that, you know, we can foresee doing within 10 years, right?
Absolutely. And when you think about models like Spaceship One, that whole Spaceship Two, that whole model is around, you have a larger craft that pulls this spacecraft as high up as we can get it with a conventional or modified conventional aircraft, and then it flies from there. And that's the same idea, right? You want to use aeronautics, use other principles to avoid that big, big, big push through the heavy atmosphere to get into low Earth orbit. Well, here now you got a permanent platform, to do that. So all you need are the space planes.
Let's describe it a little bit for our audience. There's some pictures in the linked article, Phil, that shows it looks like a fairly almost standard looking building at the top of it. Of course it's sitting on top of this inflated structure with at least one set of electric elevators that go up and down this thing. Okay, So that's what they're, that's how they're foreseeing, you know, servicing the top is with something as simple as as electric elevators, probably counterweighted, right? Just like a, you know, almost a normal elevator, but at a much larger scale. And you got five stories. The runway extends over the end of the five decks in both directions, but it's relatively short. It's it's a relatively short runway. You know, I would think that if you needed a little more runway, you'd just fly off the end of it and point your nose down and then go up. You know, to get the speed you need, right? But it's a fascinating idea, and
unless you need a little runway to land, presumably you don't land up there. Maybe you do. I'm not sure. Maybe you elevator the plane back up when you land.
Yeah, he was describing in this article landing for purposes of refueling and going again, single stage to orbit and go back and forth. What a neat idea! And imagine what it would be like to vacation in the hotel at the top of this thing, Phil. I mean, obviously you don't step outside. You are much higher than you could go outside or anything. You are practically in outer space, but you still have 1G, so you don't feel lighter as you're walking around. You still feel the Earth's gravity. And so you can avoid the space sickness, but you plainly see the curvature of the Earth all around you. The sky is dark above you all the time, and it would be, in some ways, it would be the next best thing to go into space. And for some people, they would prefer this to go into space.
Well, you could count this, I think, as space base camp. Right. If nothing else, if it's
yeah,
not space, it's closing in on space. You get an awful lot of the space experience being there. And in fact, I've got some of what you're talking about listed under one of my categories of adjacent possibilities. So why don't we jump into those and we'll come back to all the wonderful leisure and recreational possibilities in a moment. But this is what struck me about this idea. As I'm reading this article, they're suddenly talking about things I hadn't even thought of that were implications of this, but that are made immediately possible because, where in the world you didn't used to have a 20-kilometer high tower, now you got one. And when you have one, suddenly there are things you could do that you couldn't do before. Yes, you can launch these space planes, and we're going to talk about space, but you can do other stuff too. And it got me thinking, okay, well, let's make a laundry list of everything we can think of that this model opens up. And so, okay, first, definitely all the space stuff. This is awesome. You can move space, you can move material and people into space more easily. So if we want to talk about, we want to mine the asteroids, we want to settle on the moon, we want to go, just even have a mission to the moon, a mission to Mars, any of that kind of stuff, you've got the ideal staging for that with something like this. This is a great way to get anything you would want to do with a space program going. We talked about the fact that people staying there would essentially be in space. Also, they'd be staged for real space tourism, right? You get on one of the rockets and you actually fly into space from there, so that's nice. If you put several of these around the world, it occurred to me, because I don't think there would just be one of these. I think let's build one in some of the major cities. You would also have a super fast alternative to conventional jet travel. You know how we're always hearing about someday we're going to get supersonic jets back, right? And there's always been these promises of rocket planes that'll get you anywhere in the world in 2 hours. Well, this is the thing that would enable that, simply, right?
Oh, yeah.
And
you wouldn't even have to go into space. You could just fly from tower to tower, right?
Exactly, yeah. You got the rockets already. These wouldn't have to be quite as sophisticated because you don't really have to go into orbit. You just describe a nice arc and get up to near orbital speed, and boom, you've gone from London to Tokyo in a couple hours, tops, right? In fact, anywhere there's a tower, you'd be, I think, unless I'm doing the math wrong, you'd be 2 hours or less away from.
And from any other tower.
Like, from any other tower. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So ultimately, the long-haul flight business would be reduced to 2 hours, assuming that the towers got built, you know, and the planes got built. And, yeah, obviously there's assumptions here. But this is a possibility. We often hear about it. We never seem to get very close to it. And I wonder if maybe this basic piece of infrastructure has been missing, which is this very tall, at the edge of space structure that enables us to easily fly super fast planes into near orbit, you know, without having to have the big booster launch from the ground, but also without having to have them like launched out of the bottom of another plane or something like that. You solve both those problems, and you've opened up a whole new era, really, of high speed intercontinental transportation. So there you go. That's a pretty cool adjacent possibility. Could you think of any others around just the space possibilities itself, Stephen?
Yes, and there are some others that are that you pointed to, Phil, that I'm sure you'll get to in a second. But this was not listed. How about an observatory? You know, the great thing about Hubble is that it doesn't have the atmosphere between it and outer space, so it can take these wonderful pictures. But the terrible thing about Hubble is you can't get to it to fix it when it needs to be fixed very easily. We did it once, at least once. We sent a shuttle crew up and fixed it to where it went from, you know, very blurry images to all of a sudden, you know, the universe opened up to us. But what if we had an observatory at the top of one of these things? There's ever a problem, you know, it wouldn't be a big thing to fix it, and it could be right there, that would just be an amazing thing for an observatory, both traditional telescopes as well as radio telescopes.
What a great idea! By the way, side note: have you seen the IMAX movie about the repairs of the Hubble?
I have not. Should I see it?
You should definitely. I took the kids to see that a few months ago. It was showing at the Denver Museum of Natural History. They have an IMAX theater there, and they show these science movies. Let me tell you, it is a real white-knuckle, edge-of-your-seat kind of experience watching that story. And I'm sure they framed it and set it up and everything, but just, you know, the whole mission, whether they're going to get it done, whether, you know, people are going to have their spacesuits depressurized and die on space. I mean, it's a lot more suspenseful and dramatic than you would ever think. It's a great story, and you just reminded me of it. So, check out that movie.
And it was, and you know, Hubble was this joke before that mission.
Yeah,
you know, I mean,
right.
You know, there's a Far Side cartoon that showed that we needed glasses or something like that, and there was aliens like trying to wave at us and stuff, and all we saw was this blurriness, and so of course this heroic mission had to be sent up to fix it, and of course Hubble has been a complete success since that time. But it's beginning to wear out now, isn't it, Phil? And I don't think there's any plans on the books to do anything about it now. It's just going to, you know, crash to Earth with no replacement in sight, and so that's a shame. And you could have a near Hubble type situation at the top of every one of these things.
Yeah, well, I know we do have other telescopes out there now. We have one at one of the Lagrange points, but you're right. I mean, you have to look at Hubble and say just one of the great successes in the whole history of science, right? Hubble. I mean, it's up there with anything that's ever been done. And it's a real shame to see that come to an end if that's what's going to happen. But it has to do with budgets and infrastructure and who you're going to send and how you're going to get them up there, and you know, there's an awful lot of complications around repairing the Hubble, which you'll learn if you ever get a chance to watch that to watch that movie. But I hope they get it fixed. Certainly if we had a space elevator, it'd be no problem, right? If we had one of these going, we could get up there and fix the Hubble. All the more reason that we need to be working on some kind of technology like this. Okay, so that's space. Or did you have any others? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off if you had more.
Well, there are more, but I believe they were on your list, Phil. Communication.
Well, I just mean space related.
That.
Yeah, okay, so the next category I had was energy, and this was I mentioned this in the headline. You could put wind turbines on these towers rather than the low towers we're currently using. So the same windmills you see for generating power. And the engineer who's designed this thing, he says that the strong, steady winds up there at about 12 kilometers up, so what is it, a little more than halfway up the tower, would make the wind turbines equivalent to nuclear power in terms of their output. So it's like, hey, how do you power this whole thing? Well, turns out you can put wind turbines on it, and they're going to generate tons of power. And in fact, that's almost another reason just for building tall towers. It's like, you know, why are we wasting time with these inconsistent and relatively weak winds that we have down here at this level, when if we want to use wind as an energy source, the good stuff's all happening up there, right? It's all happening at about...
And it happens all the time. Yeah,
exactly. It's
not
like non-stop.
Yeah.
8 or 9 miles up.
Yep.
Yeah, that's where you need to be. If you want to collect wind, well,
now,
there's
the top
a spot.
Of these towers, my understanding feels the top of these towers are actually above, you know, the most of the wind action. So you would set up the collection grid or whatever you want, however you want to call it. The turbines would be at a lower point on the tower, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. The top of the tower is at about 20 kilometers. The ideal spot for the turbines is at about 12. So just a little more than halfway up the tower. That's where you're going to position those turbines. Probably, you know, there's probably like a, I don't know, 1,000-meter sweet spot in there somewhere.
Yeah,
right?
It's probably bigger than that. It's probably a pretty big sweet spot, getting all the way up, you're exactly right. There'd be a huge amount of power you could generate that from that. And I guess it probably differs somewhat as to what part of the world you're building one of these towers at. And which brings me to another point, Phil. I hope this doesn't take us off topic too much, but, you know, wouldn't it be better to do one of these at the equator rather than just any spot in the world? Or what's the thought on that?
You know what? I haven't read any discussion one way or another. Why are you thinking the equator would be better?
Well, you know, when Jules Verne wrote his book about, you know, going to the moon, he predicted correctly almost exactly where they would launch from. Southern, he figured it'd be the Americans that might do it, and he said, well, the southernmost point in the United States is the southern tip of Florida. I think that they'll launch from there. So in his book From Earth to the Moon, that's where he described it being launched from. Why? Because there's an advantage to being as close to the equator as you can get. You just get an advantage. So what if you got on an equatorial mountain and then built up from there? The tallest equatorial mountain is in Ecuador, and it's Chimborazo, and it's not the tallest mountain on Earth, but it is the point. If you're standing on top of that mountain, you're standing at that point that is furthest from the Earth's center. Why is that? Because the Earth is spinning, and the Earth is not a perfect ball. It's flattened at the poles and puffy in the middle, like a middle-aged guy, right? So if you're standing on top of that mountain, you're actually higher or further from the Earth's center than you would be at the top of that.
And how high is the peak?
The elevation, 20,000 feet. So
20,000 feet, so 7,000 meters. See, this is one of the things they actually talk about in the article, is that launching from mountains is exactly the idea, okay? That's one of the things they said. Yeah, find like in the article they said a 5,000-meter peak, right? And then you only have to build a tower that's 15,000 meters tall, so you've just saved a lot of inflatables and all the rest of it,
This is right at the equator. So, hey, let's predict now, just like Jules Verne's, you know, did, saying it was South Florida. I predict that they build the first one of these things on top of this particular mountain, Chimborazo. Why? Because it's at the equator, and it has an elevation of not 5,000 meters, but 6,268 meters. And you'd save so much if you could build your first one there.
There you go.
Anyway,
well, possibly
just throwing that up.
Possibly so.
Yeah.
Although,
I
can't.
Want, there,
Definitely. Well, you know, I've been looking at Ecuador pretty hard, so now, you know, it's
now you got another
short list. Yeah. But I think I wonder if the equator thing, this is where we need one of our rocket friends to help us out. I wonder if the equator thing has to do with the fact that a rocket is launching more or less straight up, right? And that's maybe the best place to kind of angle that into orbit. Whereas if you're taking off in a space plane, of course, you're always less than a couple hours from the equator anyway. I wonder if maybe that offsets that difference to some extent. I'm not sure. We would need an aeronautical / aerospace person to talk us through that. But
beyond my pay grade. I'm sorry I can't answer that.
Anyone listening to this wants to send me an email, I promise I'll read it next week. We're gonna, you know, listener mail is gonna become a new feature on the show. So that's pretty cool. The energy thing is cool. Communication you mentioned, Stephen, if you want to talk about that one.
Yeah. So the top of one of these things, the guy who is proposing this, you know, he's got some graduate students working on this, and one of the things that the graduate students were able to work out is that you got line of sight for 1,000 kilometers. Is that right, Phil?
That's what I read. Yeah.
From the top of one of these things. So, if Phil, you had suggested that if you had one of these things in Denver, it would have line of sight to Kansas City, Kansas.
Yeah, there you go. Actually, you wouldn't do it in Denver. To your point.
No.
You put it on top
of
Mount Evans, right, or one of these 14ers. I don't think we have any 15ers, but you know, close to 5,000 meters. You put it on one of those, and yeah, you would have line of sight. You know, not to Kansas, to Kansas City, right? I mean, all the way to Missouri, you'd be able to transmit whatever, you know, TV signals.
Certainly all the way to the West Coast too, you know, easily. So imagine if you were using that to provide, I don't know, national Wi-Fi or something like that.
Exactly.
You know, that'd be one way you could do it without having to put up a bunch of satellites that can break down.
I don't have a map
have
in front of me. I think you might need one booster somewhere in the Sierra Nevadas to get all the way to the West Coast. I'm not sure. But,
okay.
You could get a long way out into the plains, and you could get a long way out into the nothing, right? That lies between, say, the Rocky Mountains and the West Coast. I'm not quite sure if you could get to the. I'm not quite sure. It's a great point. Maybe that very end of Southern California might be close enough. I'm not sure. But the point is, it's a footprint not unlike that of a satellite, much smaller than a satellite, but much, much, much bigger than you currently get from any cell tower, TV tower, transmitter tower that exists, even on top of the highest mountains. And if you know, here in Colorado, we see this, you know, mountaintops often have big structures on them that are, sending signals into the city or it's a technology that's not as relied on these days because of satellites and because of cell phones and things like that, but it's still something that that exists and is important, and this would be a real game changer for that kind of stuff. A few of these towers and maybe a few lighter-than-air quasi-satellites, you know, kind of
helium
balloons.
Yeah, like Google keeps playing around with. Yeah.
Right, exactly. A few of these towers and a few of those, and you've got a whole new way of managing data and information transfer. I mean, the possibilities are really almost endless. And again, it's a possibility gets opened up because you built this tower for this completely different purpose, right? You didn't build the tower as a communication tower, but you look at it and you go, hey, you know what? It's already there. What else can we do with it? And that's another thing. Which brings me.
Just a little piece of trivia. That's what saved the Eiffel Tower. They were going to bring after the World's Fair or the exhibition or whatever that prompted the building of it. They were actually going to tear down the Eiffel Tower. You know, it was meant to be a temporary structure. And then why don't we use it for a radio tower? That's what saved the Eiffel Tower. You know, you can't imagine Paris without it now. But they were going to bring it on down and. They decided, we know what, we'll use it as a radio tower. That's just a piece of trivia there.
Built as essentially an ornament and an observation tower.
Yeah.
Built as an attraction. Great example of kind of unintended consequences, Eiffel Tower, right? Not only the the functionality that it's had as a radio tower, but also just becoming like this iconic symbol of the city, where it was at the time it was built considered kind of an eyesore and an atrocity, right? It's interesting. Interesting how those things turn around. And I'm sure that one of the objections that would be raised to these towers is that they would be ugly, or, you know, there would be concern about their environmental impact, that people don't want to have to look at them. Although I'll tell you what, if you can taper it and make it look like the Burj Khalifa off in the distance, I wouldn't have a problem. It's okay with me if they build one around here.
I think it'd be beautiful. I think you'd see just a little line kind of going, tracing up into the sky, and it would not be anything that would be unattractive at all. It'd
yeah.
be beautiful.
Unless you live close to it, then it would be enormous. That's true. But
yeah.
But you know what? Big buildings are big. There you go. There.
Yeah. Deal with it.
A little bit of philosophy for you there on a Wednesday yeah. evening. Okay, so now I want to talk about, speaking of things
in
that
honor
they weren't
of Yogi
thinking
Berra, of. You said build, in honor of Yogi Berra, Phil says, big buildings are big. Okay.
Exactly right. Well, we should note, since you brought it up, Yogi Berra, my all-time, one of the greatest baseball players of all time. It gets way overlooked. He was a fantastic baseball player, and definitely one of the great philosophers of the 20th and 21st century. My personal favorite, when you come to a fork in the road, take it.
Please take it.
The other one I like a lot is that restaurant has become so popular, nobody goes there anymore. Zen master ever issued a koan better than that. That is just perfect. That is just Zen perfect.
One of my favorites, considering that you know, he has now passed away, is that his wife asked him, well, where should we bury you? You know, and you know, around the Baseball Hall of Fame, or here at home, or you know, where you grew up. He says, "Well, why don't you just surprise me?" Anyway, I hope it's a nice.
Okay,
surprise,
one more. Okay, look, I'm sorry. Since the genre has been introduced, one more Yogi Berra funeral joke. Apparently, okay. He at one time said, "You should definitely go to other people's funerals, because if you don't, they won't come to yours."
I love it. I just love that.
There you go. All right. Yeah. So speaking of the adjacent possible, here's the thing that that they probably weren't thinking of, but man, the possibilities are almost endless. Recreation, sports, and leisure uses for this kind of a tower. I started thinking about this, and you could go on forever. Okay, there are so many possibilities, but the obvious ones, the ones that come to mind, how about skydiving? You know, an ultimate form of skydiving, right? A hobbyist essentially reenacting that big Red Bull dive. Obviously, it would have to be licensed and certified and trained. It would be like scuba diving in terms of the amount of preparation you'd have to go through. But, you know, you think people wouldn't do that? I mean, they would they would sell out the hotel just for people coming wanting to jump off the top of the thing, you know.
The training to do so. Well, you know, think of the epic wingsuit flight you could have from one of those things. You know,
absolutely.
I mean, you could jump off of that and, you know, and touch down, 100 miles away. You know, I mean, it's that you could really have a, you could really be Batman for a minute there. That would be great.
About it, you know, you could do variations with high altitude gliding, like, you know, regular gliders. That have to be pressurized, right? You have to be essentially wearing a spacesuit, because you could go, I mean, I don't know, you could go halfway around the world if you start that high. I can't even imagine how far you could go. But you know, maybe hang gliding. There's a lot of interesting skydiving / aviation possibilities there, you know, kind of where those two things meet. I think whole new sports would emerge around a structure like this. I really think we can't even. It's almost a singularity of jumping and flying.
Singularity.
Sport. Yeah.
Well, hey, you mentioned climbing. Imagine the epic, you know, rock climbing experience you could have. Within the confines of the tower, of course, not on the outside.
It would have to be inside, and you'd have to pressurize the inside, because nobody's going to make, you know, I mean, what a challenge, right? You're talking 20 kilometers, that's half a marathon, right? Am I doing the math right there? I believe that's right. Straight up, okay? So even if it was stairs or a ramp, it would be an unbelievable challenge. But yeah, imagine trying to climb to the top of it. You couldn't do it outside because no spacesuit would last long enough. You wouldn't have air long enough to do it. You'd have to have like re-tanking stations or something like that. I mean, who knows? Maybe they would go to all those extremes. But I'm telling you, people would be climbing up and climbing down that thing all over the place. All right, that would be a huge part of the attraction.
Think of the hiking that could be involved, and you'd have little camps along the way where this is about a day's hike up, and you can stop here and spend the night. On the way to the hotel at the top, you're gonna have to stop four or five times or whatever, and spend the night at these little way stations going up. That'd be a fascinating sport right there.
That's a cool image. Yeah, you know, would there be little beds, or would you carry a tent? How would it work? I don't know. There's a lot of different ways they could make that work. Obviously, you'd need running water and air and things like that in there, all the way up, toilet facilities of some kind, occasionally. But and people would do it just for the challenge, right? Just to be able to say, I climbed or walked, or probably one of those two, ran maybe. 12 miles straight up. I ran from the earth into space. I mean, who wouldn't want to be able to say that? I climbed from the earth into space. That's an amazing accomplishment, right? People would be doing it in droves. And I think, it'd be a lot easier to do than, say, Everest, because
you're in a pressurized environment, yeah.
Yeah, if they put it down there in the Andes, you actually would have to get to the top of an Everest-like mountain first, so maybe not. But depending on where they put it and how easy access is to the base of it, all kinds of possibilities there. And one other related to skydiving, in groups skydiving, in a pressurized elevator car, how about this idea? You could experience weightlessness. Okay, here's, as you mentioned, Stephen, you got the 1G going for you as you're a guest in the hotel. But on your way home, they could drop you really fast, right? They could just let you fall for quite a while, right? In the same way that the Red Bull driver, fell for about, I think, 4 or 5 minutes before he opened his parachute. Well, here I think you could get at least 2 or 3 minutes in of sheer free fall, absolute weightlessness inside that pressurized container. So you could essentially have the same experience that someone in orbit has as they're, orbiting the Earth. You would experience the same weightlessness they have for a couple of minutes. Which is actually better, I think, than what you get off the airplanes that provide that, right? That's usually just like 15, 20 seconds at a time. This would be a couple minutes of weightlessness, and plus you get home quick, right? it's like it takes a long time to get up the elevator, but, man, you can come down really fast, right? Obviously, it would need brakes, and it would slow down, and the last part of the descent would be nice and stately. But there you have it. Just off the top of our heads, and I'm sorry, Stephen, did you have other recreational possibilities?
Oh, no, I think we covered a good bit of it, and we are out of time, Phil.
There it is. So the adjacent possible for us now is to find out what our music is.
Half a Million by Michael Ellis.
Michael Ellis with Half a Million. Well, thanks, Stephen, for putting that together. Always great talking with you. Thank you all for being with us. We'll be back again next week with an all-new show, and until next time, live to see it.
I'm not afraid of monsters. I'm not afraid to die. I'm not the only one to dream that something you can buy. You keep me going forward. You keep me looking back, but will you keep me on the ground, or will I fail you on the track?